A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's personal. He and his family moved to Israel expecting the same social safety net they saw in healthcare, in animal welfare, in the laws that mandate solar water heaters on every roof. Instead, they found themselves in a rental market where a landlord can evict you with 30 days' notice and no reason at all. And the question he's asking is, how did we get here? Not just in Israel, but in the world. How did land go from something distributed among families, something that returned to its original owners every 50 years under biblical law, to a financial asset where the only way to have a home is to amass enough capital at whatever price the market decides? That's the arc we're tracing today.
The timing couldn't be sharper. Tel Aviv rental inflation just hit 8.2% year over year as of last month. The Knesset Committee on Rent Control is deadlocked for the third consecutive session. So we're sitting here with a country that banned fur farming, that mandates universal health care, that will fine you for not putting solar panels on a new building, and yet renters have fewer protections than in almost any other developed economy. The contradiction is almost physically uncomfortable.
It's the kind of gap where you look at it and think, someone must have a plan, and then you realize, no, they really don't. So where do we start?
We start with the user's story, because it's the entry point that makes this real. A family moves to Israel, they've read about the social legislation, the progressive values, the way the country talks about justice and protecting the stranger. They sign a lease. And then they discover that tenancy law here is essentially the 1971 rent and loan law with a few amendments, and it reads like a contract law textbook from a time when nobody was thinking about tenants as a protected class. No rent stabilization. No eviction for cause requirement. No habitability standards with teeth. You can be a perfect tenant, never miss a payment, and still be out on the street in a month.
Daniel's question has two layers. The surface layer is, why doesn't Israeli law reflect Jewish values when it comes to housing? But the deeper layer is historical. He's asking when and how land became a commodity in the first place. Because the Bible and the Talmud assume a world where land is distributed, inherited, and periodically redistributed. The Jubilee year, the Yovel, mandated that every 50 years land return to its original tribal allotment. You couldn't permanently sell land. You could lease it for a period, but the price was calculated based on how many harvests remained until the next Jubilee. Land was never permanently alienable.
And this isn't just a symbolic thing. Leviticus 25 lays it out in detail. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me. The theological foundation is that God owns the land, and humans are tenants. You can't sell what you don't own. The Talmud and Bava Metzia goes further into the practical side. There are discussions about what happens when a landlord rents out a house and it collapses. The ruling is that the landlord has to provide a functional dwelling. You can't charge rent for a pile of rubble. There's also a prohibition on evicting a tenant during winter in some interpretations, because where are they supposed to go?
Which is more than Israeli secular courts require today, by the way. We'll come back to that. But here's the thing Daniel noticed. All of these ancient protections assume a world of smallholder farmers, and maybe some urban craftsmen. The idea that you'd have a city where the majority of people rent apartments from strangers, where land ownership is concentrated in the hands of institutional investors, where your home is a line item in a pension fund's quarterly report, that world would have seemed absurd to the rabbis of the Talmud. So something happened between then and now. A mass transfer.
That's what we need to trace. The great transformation from land as a social trust to land as a commodity. And the pivot point, the place where the mechanism really got built, is England between about 1760 and 1840, the Enclosure Acts.
The Enclosure Acts, which sounds like a dry administrative footnote, but was actually one of the most consequential redistributions of wealth in human history.
It really was. Before enclosure, English villages operated on an open field system. Peasants had strips of land they cultivated, but they also had common rights, grazing land, woodlands for foraging and fuel. These commons were essential. They meant that even a landless laborer could keep a few animals, gather firewood, survive independently. The land wasn't owned in the modern sense. It was held through a web of feudal obligations and customary rights that went back centuries.
Then Parliament started passing acts, one by one, that let large landowners fence off the commons and claim them as private property. Between 1760 and 1840, about 6,000 enclosure acts were passed. Something like 7 million acres, about a fifth of England's total area, went from common land to private land.
The justification was efficiency. The argument was that common land was underused, that private ownership would incentivize investment and increase agricultural output. And to be fair, agricultural productivity did increase. But the cost was the creation of a landless class. People who had survived on the commons now had nothing to sell but their labor. They moved to cities, they became factory workers, they rented cramped housing from landlords who had no relationship to them beyond the monthly payment. This was the birth of the modern rental market, and it was born in dispossession.
This model didn't stay in England. The British Empire exported it. Colonial administrators looked at common land systems in India, in Africa, in the Middle East, and saw waste. They imposed private property regimes because that's what they understood, and because it made land taxable and alienable in ways that benefited colonial extraction.
Which brings us to Palestine. Before the British Mandate, the Ottoman Land Code of 1858 had already begun the shift. The Ottomans required land registration for the first time, partly to increase tax revenue. But many peasants deliberately didn't register their land because registration meant conscription and taxation. So large tracts were registered in the names of wealthy urban families who often didn't even live on the land. The British Mandate continued this process, passing the land transfer ordinances that formalized private property and made land a tradable asset.
Then 1948 happens, and the new State of Israel inherits this patchwork. The 1960 Israel Land Administration Law consolidates state ownership. Today, 93% of Israel's land is owned by the state or by the Jewish National Fund, which sounds socialist, right? The state owns almost everything. But here's the twist. The state leases the land on 49 or 98-year terms to developers and individuals. And the subrental market, the apartments people actually live in, that's almost entirely unregulated.
This is the bizarre situation. The state is the ultimate landlord. It has more leverage over land than any government in the democratic world, and it has chosen not to use that leverage to regulate the rental market. If the state owns 93% of the land, it could attach conditions to every lease. It could say, if you develop on state land, your rental units are subject to rent stabilization. It could create a national rent registry. It could require just cause for eviction. It has done none of these things.
The question becomes, why not? And this is where we have to set aside the idea that Israel's rental market is unregulated because of some consistent free market ideology. Israel's economy is heavily regulated in lots of sectors. The food industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the energy sector. The government intervenes constantly. The rental gap isn't ideological consistency. It's a political story.
It's a lobbying story. In 2024, a Knesset bill was introduced that would have required just cause for eviction. The Real Estate Association spent 12 million shekels lobbying against it. The bill failed. And the real estate lobby's argument is predictable. They say regulation will reduce the supply of rental units, that landlords will take apartments off the market, that new construction will slow down. It's the same argument you hear everywhere.
Is it true? The evidence from other countries is more complicated than that simple trade-off. Germany has some of the strongest tenant protections in the world. 55% of households rent. Eviction protections are robust. Rent increases are controlled. Tenant associations have legal standing in housing court. And Germany does not have a shortage of rental housing. New York City's Rent Stabilization Code, passed in 1969, covers about 1 million apartments. Rent increases are tied to a board set percentage. Tenants have eviction protection and the right to lease renewal. New York's rental market has problems, but the protections didn't cause a mass exodus of landlords.
The German case is especially interesting because of the legal reasoning. The German Constitution has a social state principle, the Sozialstaat, which courts have interpreted to mean that housing is not just a commodity. It's a social good, and the state has an obligation to ensure access. Israel's basic law on human dignity and liberty could theoretically support similar arguments. The courts have just never extended it to tenancy.
Here's where we get to one of the most ironic parts of this whole story. Some of the most progressive tenant protections in Israel exist in the rabbinical courts, the Bitei Din, the Jewish legal arbitration courts. These courts routinely rule that landlords must give 6 to 12 months notice before eviction. They rule that you can't evict during winter. They sometimes require landlords to pay relocation costs. These are rulings grounded in halakhic principles about protecting the vulnerable and treating the stranger fairly.
Here's the catch. These rulings only apply to the minority of tenants who voluntarily submit to religious arbitration. The secular court system does not adopt these standards. So you have this bizarre situation where the legal system that most explicitly claims to apply Jewish values has stronger tenant protections than the secular system, but most tenants can't access it. And many wouldn't want to, because submitting to religious arbitration means accepting the authority of a system they may not share.
The Jewish values are there. The legal reasoning is there. The precedents are there. What's missing is the political will to translate them into civil law.
To understand why that political will is missing, we need to talk about what happened in the 1990s. This is the financialization moment. Israel deregulated its mortgage market, encouraged foreign investment in real estate, and opened the door to institutional investors treating rental housing as an asset class. The numbers tell the story. In 2010, institutional investors, pension funds, insurance companies owned 4% of rental apartments in Tel Aviv. By 2022, that number was 18%. Projections have it reaching 30% by 2030.
This changes the nature of the landlord-tenant relationship entirely. When your landlord is a pension fund, there is no personal relationship. There's no neighbor who owns the apartment next door and rents it out to supplement their income. There's a portfolio manager in a tower in Tel Aviv or New York who is legally obligated to maximize returns for shareholders. If raising the rent 30% maximizes returns, and the law allows it, they will raise the rent 30%. If evicting a family and renovating the unit to relist at a higher price maximizes returns, they will do that.
That's exactly what's happening. The renovation eviction loophole is rampant in Tel Aviv. Landlords issue 60-day eviction notices claiming they're going to renovate. The tenant moves out. The unit gets a coat of paint and some new fixtures, and it's relisted at 30% higher rent. The former tenant has no legal standing to verify whether the renovation actually happened, no right to return at the old rent, no recourse at all.
In 2023, there was what people called the eviction winter in Jerusalem's Katamonim neighborhood. 47 families were evicted from a single building in December. The municipality provided temporary hotel housing for 2 weeks. After that, families were on their own. Compare that to Berlin, where winter evictions are banned outright. You cannot evict someone between October and March in Berlin. It's illegal. The reasoning is that forcing someone onto the street in winter is inhumane.
That's the gap. That's what Daniel and his family experienced. Not necessarily a mass eviction, but the constant insecurity of knowing that your home is contingent. That no matter how good a tenant you are, no matter how reliably you pay, your lease can end and you have no right to renew. You can be uprooted at the landlord's discretion.
This insecurity has knock-on effect that ripple through the entire housing market. When renting is insecure, homeownership stops being a choice and becomes a necessity. People who might prefer to rent, who might value flexibility or want to live in neighborhoods where buying is impossible, are forced into the purchase market. This drives up demand, inflates prices, and makes the wealth gap worse.
The numbers on this are stark. Israel's overall home ownership rate is about 72%, which sounds healthy. But among people under 35, it's dropped from 55% in the year 2000 to 38% in 2025. So the people who can't buy are trapped in an unregulated rental market, paying ever higher rents to institutional landlords with no security and no path to stability.
The tenant organizing that might push back against this barely exists. There are 3 registered tenant organizations in the entire country. For comparison, Germany has hundreds of tenant associations, many with legal staff who represent tenants in court. The German Tenants Association has over 3 million members and a budget that lets it challenge bad landlords systematically.
What would change require? A coalition of tenant unions that don't yet exist, political will to challenge a real estate lobby that spent 12 million shekels to kill the last reform bill, and a reframing of rental housing as a social good rather than a market commodity. The 2026 Fair Rent Bill is currently in committee. It would create a national rent registry and cap annual increases to the Consumer Price Index plus 1%. Its chances of passing are estimated at about 30%.
That 30% estimate is generous, honestly. The real estate lobby is organized, funded, and focused. Tenants are diffuse, under-resourced, and most of them don't even know what rights they currently have, let alone what rights they're missing.
Which is worth a quick detour, because there are some rights under current law that tenants often don't know about. The 1971 Rent and Loan Law, as amended, does give you the right to a written contract. You have the right to deduct repair costs from rent if the landlord fails to fix critical issues after reasonable notice. You have protection from eviction during the fixed term of your lease. The problem is, what happens after the fixed term ends? At that point, you have no right to renewal. The landlord can simply decline to renew, and you have 30 days to leave.
30 days to find a new home, pack your life, and move your family. In a tight rental market with 8% annual inflation, that's not a right to housing. That's a right to be temporarily housed at someone else's pleasure.
This is where the international comparisons really land. In Germany, a landlord can only terminate a lease for specific reasons. They need the unit for themselves or immediate family. The tenant has violated the lease terms in a material way. Or the landlord wants to demolish and rebuild, and even then, the tenant gets extensive notice and often relocation assistance. In New York, rent-stabilized tenants have a right to lease renewal. The landlord cannot simply decide not to renew. In France, evictions are banned during winter months nationwide. In the Netherlands, rent increases for sitting tenants are capped by law.
Israel has none of these. And the question Daniel is asking is, how did a country founded by people who fled persecution, who understand what it means to be vulnerable, who built a state that prides itself on social solidarity, end up here?
Part of the answer is that Israel's founding generation was focused on ownership. The Zionist project was about Jews returning to the land, literally, owning it, cultivating it, making it bloom. The early state invested massively in homeownership through programs like the Amidar Housing Company and subsidized mortgages for new immigrants. Renting was seen as a temporary state, something you did until you could buy. The law was written for that world.
The world changed. Housing prices in the center of the country detached from median incomes. The dream of homeownership receded for a generation, but the law didn't change with it. The 1971 law was amended here and there, but the basic architecture, the assumption that renting is transitional and landlords need flexibility, remained intact.
There's also a cultural dimension. In many Israeli families, real estate is the primary vehicle for building wealth. Parents buy apartments for their children. Grandparents leave apartments as inheritances. The system depends on property values rising. Anything that might slow that appreciation, like rent control, is seen as a threat to the family balance sheet, not just to institutional investors.
You have a political coalition against reform that includes not just the real estate industry, but also a large chunk of middle-class homeowners who see their apartment's value as their retirement plan. That's a hard coalition to break.
Which brings us back to the deeper historical question Daniel asked. When did this mass transfer happen? When did land go from a social trust to a financial asset? And the answer is, it wasn't a single moment. It was a series of transformations, each one layering new assumptions on top of old ones. The Enclosure Acts created the concept of absolute private property in land. Colonial administration exported that concept globally. The rise of mortgage markets and institutional investment turned housing into an asset class. And at each stage, the people who depended on the old system, the commoners, the tenants, the renters, lost ground.
The Jubilee model isn't coming back. We're not going to redistribute land every 50 years. But the principle underlying the Jubilee, that land has a social function beyond its market price, that housing is not just another commodity, that's worth reviving. And it's not a radical idea. It's embedded in the German Constitution. It's embedded in New York's rent stabilization code. It's embedded in the winter eviction bans across Europe. These are mainstream policies in functioning market economies.
It's embedded in Jewish law if anyone bothered to apply it. The rabbinical courts are already doing this. They're ruling that tenants deserve notice, that eviction in winter is wrong, that landlords have obligations beyond collecting rent. The legal reasoning exists. The precedents exist. What's missing is the political decision to make those protections universal rather than optional.
For listeners who are renting in Israel right now, what can you actually do? First, know your rights under the current law. Get a written contract. If the landlord fails to fix critical issues, you can deduct repair costs from rent after giving reasonable notice. You're protected during the fixed term. Second, pay attention to municipal politics. Tel Aviv and Haifa have passed bylaws requiring landlords to register vacant units and pay a tax on apartments held empty for more than 6 months. These local initiatives create pressure for national reform, and they're harder for the real estate lobby to kill than the said bills.
Third, and this is the harder one, support tenant organizing. Those three registered tenant organizations need members, need funding, need to grow into something that can counterbalance the real estate lobby. The German Tenants Association didn't start with 3 million members. It started with a few dozen people who were tired of being pushed around.
The deeper lesson from this whole investigation is that when we ask why doesn't Israel's law reflect Jewish values, we're asking the wrong question. The values are there. They're in the biblical text, they're in the Talmud, they're in the rabbinical court rulings. The question is, who benefits from keeping them out of civil law? And the answer is, a coalition of institutional investors, property owners, and a political system that treats housing as an asset first, and a human need second.
Understanding how we got here, tracing that arc from the Commons to the Enclosure Acts to the financialization of rental housing, is the first step to imagining something different. The Jubilee was a radical idea in its time, and it's still radical now. Debt is forgiven. People get a fresh start. We don't have to recreate that exactly. But the principle that the market is not the only way to value land, that there are other claims on it, other ways to organize our relationship to the places we live, that principle is worth holding on to.
The Fair Rent Bill sits in committee with a 30% chance of passing. 47 families in Catamonium are still recovering from an eviction winter that should never have happened. Daniel and his family are far from alone in feeling that the system failed them. But the question he asked, how did we get here, is the one that might actually point the way forward.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1960s, proponents of the phantom time hypothesis claimed that approximately 300 years of the early medieval period, including the entire Carolingian era, were fabricated by Holy Roman Emperor Otto III and Pope Sylvester II, meaning that everything we think happened between 614 and 911 AD never actually occurred. The hypothesis further alleges that archaeological evidence from Mongolia during this non-existent period was planted by the same conspirators.
Mongolia was fabricating evidence during centuries that didn't exist. That tracks, honestly.
I have so many questions, and I'm not sure any of them have answers.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to send us a question like Daniel did, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everything.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.